Hello, a very warm welcome back to you. I'm glad that you are joining us. Today in the Gita Decoded, we are going to be going through the last few verses, shlokas of chapter 5 of the Bhagavad Gita, in which Sister Denise, our speaker, will be sharing her understanding of what this means. And thank you once again for joining us. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Sister Denise, I note that in verses 18 and 19, it says that a wise soul sees the soul in everything, or rather, a wise person sees the soul in everything. And once again, not being influenced by duality is emphasized. The term that came to mind this morning is equanimity. Okay, could you please tell us what the significance is of seeing the soul in everything, and how does it protect one spiritually if you do that? Equanimity, how does one remain stable in your inner world that's not stable, and in the outer world that's anything but stable?
The idea of seeing the soul in everything is because every person is a soul. Normally speaking, we see their body, but if we see the soul, then we're seeing the reality. So it is a discipline, it's a practice, and the way in which it protects us is because it makes us, or it helps us to realize that the behavior is not the person. Otherwise, we tend to label people according to their behavior. Say a person is stealing something or did steal something, we say that person is a thief from now on out. When you see the soul, it's different because the soul is an actor. The soul, okay, maybe did something wrong, but that was a scene in the drama rather than an identification of the person. So if you see everyone is a soul, you remember that they're actors, they have a predetermined, predestined role that they have to play. And this helps you to not blame them, to realize that they have no choice but to play that. So it helps you to be really detached and move on. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a very important message of the Gita. The sense organs and what you perceive, you dwell on that. So the mind is always caught up in matter. And what the knowledge of the Gita is telling us all the time is withdraw from that and keep thinking of yourself and everyone else as beings. Focus the attention on the self. Focus, even when you're looking at another person, look right through their face, which you know is a mask, and see the person within.
The aspect of not being influenced by duality, how do you understand that?
You know, there's several concepts around duality. In Brahma Kumari's Raj Yoga, duality means the one thing that's real is what you are, the soul. You look at your original condition, your ultimate condition, your permanent condition, and then the things that are occurring, you know, a circumstance arises, persists, subsides. There is duality in the sense that there is the soul, there is the body. There is more than duality in the sense that there is also God, there is also human souls, there is also matter. When you are in opposition with yourself, when you are turned away from what's real, you're split. So that kind of duality is not a good thing. Because of the concept of the omnipresence of God, it is thought that everything is God, God is in everything, God is everything, and if you see that you are separate from God, that's duality. So in Brahma Kumaris we would say you're definitely separate from God, you're a human soul, God is not a human soul, and then there's matter, which is not spirit. So there's these three energies constantly interacting with each other. So this is where there is a difference between the conventional interpretation and what we also say in Raja Yoga of Brahma Kumaris.
What I find noteworthy towards the very end of chapter 5 is that self-reliance is emphasized. Self-reliance, self-dependence, etc. Now, Sister Denise, if you look at the culture of India, irrespective of the religion that people belong to, this is not actually the case, because it is a very strong family society. Your family is very important. Yes, you get the ascetics and the yogis. That's also part of India. But the majority of the population are very firm believers in family. And yet, the Bhagavad Gita strongly teaches you, the reader, to stand on your own two feet, and speaks very specifically, chapter after chapter, of non-attachment. Not being influenced, not to come under the influence of your own weaknesses or others' weaknesses. How do you practice this if you're essentially a family person?
You have to think of yourself as an actor. You know, when people are on a movie set or a TV studio playing a sitcom, where there is a family. There are all the actors, they're playing the interactions among family members, and yet they know, I don't really belong to this family. So there's a degree of detachment right there. And in Raj Yoga, as it's practiced among Brahma Kumaris, a lot of emphasis is given to you're an actor. Yes, everyone is in families. Why do we get born into this family or that family? It is said that it is because of karmic accounts. At this present time, which we call the Kali Yuga, whoever we are drawn to, it is usually family members that we're the closest to, but there are also some others or friends, or also there's family by marriage, you know. So all of this is involving a lot of karmic debt which has to be settled. And this is really the reason why at this present historical time there is a lot of suffering within families, family feuds. Even the story of the Mahabharata is a family feud between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, who are related, they're cousins, and they have a big problem with each other to the point where it tears apart the whole world. If everything were perfectly fine, there would be no need for God to come and say the way out of your situation is to adopt the attitude of detachment. You're in a family, you take your identity from that family, that's also your caste. Your caste duty requires you to marry into somebody of the same caste so that the families and the castes and everything is held together. This is also very strongly mentioned in the scriptures. You should not marry outside your caste. And a sign of the end of the world is when people are getting married outside of their castes. And so that the status quo is disturbed when that happens.
May I ask you, in this context, what do you mean by caste?
In this context, caste is the caste you're born into. It's not to do really with your character, as we were talking in an earlier episode, but is to do with your karmic accounts. So your karma will put you into a certain caste by birth, and then with certain people with whom you have some karmic accounts. And where you're connected to people by blood, you can't, you know, say, oh, I think I'll go away. You can't. You're bound, you see. And so therefore, as a yogi in the family, within all of these karmic accounts that play out, you need your virtue, you need your powers. Otherwise, things become chaotic and you enter into a deepening of the karmic account rather than a resolution of the karmic account. Because a karmic account plays out like this. Somebody does something or behaves towards you in such a way that you take offense. And then you, having taken offense, do something offensive back to that person. So there's an escalation, there is suffering. So through the suffering, you're settling some karma, but you're not able to manage the suffering. So you become reactive and you enter into other karma, which puts you in further bondage. So you're settling and increasing at the same time. And so from the angle of God, that's not a good way to go. What you want to do at this period of time is settle, but not create more. So part of what we learn in Raj Yoga as taught at Brahma Kumaris is how to be with people that you have a karmic account with in such a way that you do not take it personally. You use your powers, your virtues, your qualities to get across those things which under normal circumstances would provoke you into doing something that will give you further bondage.
Yes, Denise, we've come to the end of the verses in chapter 5. Let's do a quick synopsis of the entire chapter. This chapter starts with the emphasis on renunciation. Okay, well, that's its title. Now, what I know from having interacted with the people that I have is that the very word renunciation scares people, okay? Because it implies a sacrifice, it involves hardship, giving up, not being with the things that you love most and the people that you love most. How do you include renunciation in your life in such a way that you do not feel as if you're depriving yourself of anything?
Very important is to be aware of what you're getting. I see.
As a result of renouncing?
No, not even as a result of renouncing. When you engage in a spiritual practice, you start to get really deeply in contact with yourself, which means that you become a lot more self-sustaining. You are less dependent on taking energy from other people. You have your own energy. Second is you're drawing energy from your yoga with God is filling you with energy and qualities and wisdom and your studies. So you're becoming much more integrated with yourself. And you're practicing to be an actor, you're practicing to be detached, so that what you're giving up is actually the things that are not very good for you or not very pleasant. Take, for example, somebody wants to give up cigarettes. It's an addictive substance, tobacco. People get into it because of various reasons, and a time comes when they want to give up cigarettes. That's a kind of renunciation, but you're renouncing something that is harmful for you. However, it's difficult because you're addicted. So renunciation, the way it is being talked about here, it is actually more like that. There's no need to renounce anything that's good for you.
We both know that it's more complicated than that now, don't we? Okay, let's get to the real issues. The Bhagavad Gita speaks of the renunciation of external things. as well as the renunciation of certain things internal. Say, in case someone who is watching you and becomes deeply inspired and has been an avid believer or reader of the Bhagavad Gita for years, now decides that it's time to give up a weakness like anger, mm-hmm. or even more subtle, ego, okay, the ever-present enemy. So the reason we have anger or have ego is that we get something out of it anyway. I was given to understand, Sister Denise, from a psychological perspective, that irrespective of whether behavior is negative or positive, but especially negative behavior, like smoking or any addiction, the reason we return to the behavior time and time again is because we get something out of it.
Smoking, getting angry, all of these things are done because one is weak.
Okay.
And what you get out of it is a temporary relief from some other negative feeling. And because it's a temporary relief, you don't really get that much out of it. An addict gets a high, which is very temporary. It's not that you're actually gaining from it. When you give up something bad, you do gain. You don't lose. Who is going to lose by no longer being enthralled to the emotion of anger? That's not a loss.
I don't doubt what you just said. It sounds beautiful and practical and doable. My point is that these weaknesses, the internal demons, have become part of our identity, albeit bad ones. And you spoke about weakness, okay? That basically describes every single person on the planet. In a previous series, I heard you use the word spiritually depleted. Okay, so that fits into this picture as well. So my question is, even though you do understand that you're acting out of weakness, how do you renounce something that makes you weaker? What is your medicine? What is your antidote? What do you gain? And Sister Denise, when you renounce anger, for a while, you will still feel the gravity of your anger pulling you. Because the moment you decide to give up anger, you know, the moment someone decides to give up cigarettes, every single friend that he's ever known who smokes will come to visit him, cigarette in hand, and offer him a whiff. That's how it works.
Yes.
Okay, you switch on the television and you'll see cigarette ads, and you drive on the road and then be five billboards all in a row with cigarette ads on top. You know how it works. How does he hold himself together that he doesn't come under the influence of that which he wants to renounce?
If a person says, yeah, I should really give up anger, I should really give up cigarettes, I should give up this or that or the other, they think, and it's presented that way, that being angry is bad. Smoking cigarettes is bad, okay? And you want to give it up because you've heard and you think it's bad. You're a bad person. Now, the angle of spirituality would suggest otherwise. You're not bad, you're weak. When people are bad, they get punished. You don't punish people for being weak. What do you do for someone who's weak? You strengthen them. If you yourself realize you're weak, you strengthen yourself. So I think that, in a sense, the word renunciation is, in a way, it's really very misleading, because the whole problem is that the soul doesn't have power. The moment the soul is full of power and continuing to draw power through the yoga, what would normally provoke you to anger doesn't, because you're powerful, you're not susceptible to it. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not like you're giving up something desirable. It's not like you're giving up something that has power over you. But look at it from the other angle. The power of the anger is only powerful relative to your weakness. you change from weak to powerful, the anger becomes neutralized. You don't have to go against it. All you have to do is empower yourself. That's it. Even with a substance abuse, it is known in addiction recovery that all you have to do is fill yourself with the experience of God, the power of God, and the craving disappears. So the craving is because of weakness.
And emptiness.
Mm. So this is really what we're looking at. So in a sense, you're renouncing a black hole into which you're about to fall. Mm. And that's really not something, oh, you poor thing, you're renouncing, you don't have any fun, da-da-da. It's not like that.
Sister Denise, I'd like to take up the subject of trauma, okay? Mm. Recently, a new friend said to me that we are all traumatized. The only question is to what degree. If a person who has experienced some level of trauma in their life is watching you right now and wants to embrace what you just said, what does he do with his pain? A vast majority of people on the planet whose reality is such that they breathe in pain and breathe out pain, and all types of pain. There's chronic physical pain, there's emotional pain, psychological, etc. So how do you deal with trauma and embrace what is contained in these chapters?
I think it's extremely useful that we're taking up the idea of trauma. Trauma is the soul is wounded. Mm-hmm. You could say we use the term drama. It happened, okay? So the soul is broken, split, however you want to call it. Of course, we know that the soul is imperishable and so on, but trauma will really badly wound the soul, which means the soul is weakened. And it's not because the soul has done anything bad necessarily, but the soul received badness through the trauma. And therefore, you have to heal. Healing the soul also requires for the soul to just hold itself under the light of God and just draw that light, that peace, that love into itself. So as much as a traumatized person can place themselves in the hands of God and absorb that into themselves, that to that extent the healing process is going on. But of course, looking at things in a practical way, most people who are traumatized will not start doing this. You get a lot of people who are traumatized in childhood. Their trauma will translate itself into coping mechanisms. Those coping mechanisms take the form of ego masks for self-protection, and various character defects arise out of this. So you're control freak is a good example of that. And then a time will come, maybe much later in life, where that person says to themselves, I think I have a problem here, and I don't know what it is, but I'm not operating properly. Maybe I need to meditate. I need to do something. You know, and this is where they will begin to open themselves up to spirituality, maybe open themselves up to God, and then the whole process of healing of the trauma can begin. You know, normally speaking, people will not study the Gita or engage in serious spiritual practice until a little bit later in life. Partly you have your life experience, partly because It involves turning away from the glitter and glamour of the world, which is very attractive, but not necessarily very beneficial for you, at least not spiritually. And so once you've been there, done that, got all the t-shirts, and you say, okay, now what I need to do is look after myself spiritually. And when you reach a certain age, you're headed towards death. Now, people who are really young, they think they're immortal because they're young. You hit 60, and then you see 70, 80, 90, and Om Shanti. And so you start thinking about that.
If you're lucky to live that long. Okay, Sister Denise, thank you. That last aspect on renunciation and what you mentioned on feelings was exceptionally powerful, so thank you for that. So, there you go, brothers and sisters, the yoga of renunciation. Sister Denise has taken us through what renunciation means and what it does not mean, and we all have our own opinions about what renunciation means to us. And the interesting thing is, throughout our lives, we've all made sacrifices at one point or the other. You sacrifice your time if you want to write an important exam. You sacrifice this to achieve that. So the question that you should be asking yourself is, if you do renounce, like this particular chapter of the Bhagavad Gita speaks of, then what do you get out of it? Sister Denise has shed light on, do not look at the renunciation itself, but look at what you get out of it. And I think that's a very important perspective. So thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you for chapter 6 of the Bhagavad Gita. Sister Denise, goodbye for now, and goodbye to you at home as well.